The headlines, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs says Tel Aviv is updating its plans for striking Iranian nuclear sites. The United Nations says it's yet to see evidence from the United Arab Emirates government that the daughter of Dubai's ruler is still alive. And Japan extends a coronavirus state of emergency in the capital, Tokyo, by 2 weeks, just less than 5 months before the Tokyo Olympics. Our top story for this half hour, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs says Tel Aviv is updating its plans for striking Iranian nuclear sites.
Recently, the Chief of Staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. But it's very important.
Gantz told Fox News that Israel has identified numerous targets inside Iran. He expressed hope that the world would stop what he called Iran's nuclear aspirations. Gantz added, if that does not happen, Israel would be ready to act independently. Iranian authorities have time and again warned of a decisive response to any possible attack by Israel. They maintain that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful and is under rigorous international inspection. That is while Israel is believed to have hundreds of nuclear warheads and does not allow inspection of its sites. Political analyst Karim Sharara joins us now from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Sharara, welcome to the program. Please give us your thoughts on the recent comments coming from the Israeli regime.
Well, thank you for having me. These comments, they aren't new at all. I mean, they're always repeated by Israeli officials. What's new about them? Well, first of all, you have to take into consideration past events, what with the UAE and Israel, the recent rapprochement, Iran has already warned Israel, and both Israel and the UAE, that they're encroaching on Iran's strategic space, and it forbade Israel from making any foolish moves. So, taking into consideration the past events, what with the targeting of the Israeli ship that the Israelis have alleged that Iran is behind the attack, tensions are high in Israel at the moment. And second of all, we have to take into account that these comments were made to Fox News, so they're pandering for a conservative viewpoint. And what they're saying is that what we're reviewing our strategy on targeting Iranian nuclear facilities. So they're saying basically that we're prepared to go to war, we're prepared to act unilaterally and go to war with Iran, or basically cause a war that will drag the U.S. with us into Iran. So this is also a message to Biden that we won't stand for you going back to the nuclear deal and easing everything that we've worked so hard to accomplish for the past few years with Iran. So there's a lot of things to take into account.
Another thing we have to take into account, Mr. Sharara, are the comments by Benny Gantz. He said Iran's... He expressed hope that the world would stop what he called Iran's nuclear aspirations. When will we see pressure on the Israeli regime for their nuclear arsenal? They won't sign the NPT. They don't have any inspections. I think it should be the other way around.
It should be the other way around, of course. But we are currently living in a world order built on unbiased and unfair grounds. The Israelis aren't going to give up any measure of their strength and allow any measure of international observation or international scrutiny of their nuclear facilities. They're allowed for Iran, of course, because that allows them to send their agents into Iranian facilities, not necessarily Israeli agents, but Western agents affiliated with Western security services into Iranian nuclear facilities in order to keep tabs on what's going on in these facilities and allow them to know who to target. That recent assassination of Shahid Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. So, of course, the Israelis aren't going to allow any measure of scrutiny into their own program. And this is a world, the whole of the UN, but basically we're talking about the Security Council. It's built on unfair grounds. It's built on the idea, the premise that we have, that the Western powers, basically, or the victors after World War II, have to keep the international security scene in line with their own interests. So this isn't going to happen because this is an encroachment on Western security. This is how it's going to be seen. So as soon as any measure of policy against Israel or against Israeli nuclear independence from all world powers is to be seen, the Americans are going to veto it. This isn't going to happen. The best thing Iran has done so far, and it's really a blessing, was it stopping compliance with the JCPOA, because it was basically an entire loss for Iran. It was, as the leader stated, it was a net loss for Iran. So the Western powers, the West in its entirety, even the Europeans, showed that they were completely dependent on American policy. They had no measure of independence. They could not even put in place the INSTEX, the mechanism in order to allow Iran to facilitate monetary transactions with Iran. This was a net loss for Iran. The best thing that could have happened is for Iran to regain its independence in the nuclear field. And this is what Israel is afraid of. It's not the nuclear, Iran's nuclear program per se, because it's just a scarecrow. It's just a scarecrow tactic that they're using. It's Iran's independence in this deal. It's Iran's possible future as a power in the region.
Thank you very much. Political analyst Karim Sharara joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Elsewhere, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has foiled a plot to hijack a plane on a domestic flight. In a statement, the IRGC said hijackers attempted to seize a Fokker 100 airplane. On Thursday night, it said the flight was en route from the southern city of Ahvaz to the holy city of Mashhad, northeast of Iran. The IRGC said the hijackers intended to direct the plane to an airport in one of the countries in the southern coasts of the Persian Gulf. It said the plane landed safely in Isfahan, with its passengers heading to their destination on another flight. The IRGC said an investigation has been launched. The United Nations says the United Arab Emirates has not yet provided a proof of life of Dubai princess Sheikha Latifa, who was found barricaded by her father in a video. The UN Human Rights Office said it held discussions with representatives of the Emirati government, but there is no particular progress on the report. The UN office had earlier asked the UAE for evidence if the daughter of Dubai's ruler, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, is alive, as well as her whereabouts. That after the British media released videos in which Latifa said she was being held against her will and that she feared for her life. The princess had tried to escape the country in 2018, but was captured and returned back to the UAE. Tensions between the United States and Iraqi resistance groups runs high. The situation is being described by some as a tinderbox, with warning against any new escalatory move by the U.S.
The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region. Biden came into office amid rising anti-American sentiments in Iraq and growing calls on Washington to pull out all American forces from Iraq. Biden's team is now faced with growing attacks on American and U.S.-led foreign forces there. Does the problem have a military solution? Despite Biden's promises of change, the White House must still be thinking that it does. Because last week, Biden ordered airstrikes on anti-Daesh resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border in what his team described as a retaliation for earlier rocket attacks against American and U.S.-led forces. The U.S. airstrikes drew condemnation from resistance fighters and pledges of retaliation. On Wednesday, a barrage of rockets was fired at the Ain al-Assad Air Base, housing American troops in Iraq's western Anbar province. Advanced air defense systems at the Ain al-Assad Air Base failed to intercept the incoming rockets. Some observers believe the aerial bombardment ordered by Biden has backfired and has made U.S. forces in the region less safe.
It backfired because it was despicable and this was seen throughout the region. Everyone sees that America's just dumping its garbage on other people's heads. So it's very bad for the whole region, if in America's terms, because it increases anti-American sentiment everywhere.
There are currently 2,500 American forces in Iraq. Resistance groups widely view them as occupiers who defy growing calls to leave. As anti-U.S. sentiments grow in Iraq, it's becoming more difficult to protect American military personnel there. The United States is struggling to protect its troops in Iraq despite intensified security measures. America's dangerous approach, which it is still refusing to abandon, is increasing the risk of broader confrontations.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. Anti-Americanism in Iraq was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attack on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces.
The Iraqi parliamentarians almost unanimously voted to expel all U.S. troops, period. And, of course, nothing has been done on that. So if a year ago the sentiment was like that, then it's only increasing. America is the enemy. America doesn't seem to get it through its head how it's perceived in Iraq and Afghanistan, wherever in the world.
But America is still refusing to heed to that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safe, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls Iranian proxy groups. But Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, Trump withdrew several hundreds of U.S. troops from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there despite his pledge to end American military presence in the region. How will Biden deal with the situation now? Observers believe by ordering the recent aerial bombardment on the Iraqi-Syrian border, he definitely had a bad start. If Biden stays on the same dangerous course, he risks further destabilizing Iraq and broader clashes with resistance groups.
Elsewhere, Pope Francis has called for an end to acts of extremism and intolerance as he begins the first ever papal visit to Iraq. The pontiff also urged a more prominent public role for Christians in Iraq as citizens with full rights, freedoms, and responsibilities. That of the Roman Catholic Church also called on Iraqi officials to combat the scourge of corruption and abuse of power. Pope Francis also pointed to the suffering of the minority Izzadis, saying they were the innocent victims of brutal atrocities at the hands of Daesh terrorists. The Pope was welcomed by Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi and President Barham Saleh for the history-making visit. He's also due to meet Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani. Yemenis have held a protest in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a to condemn the UN donor conference. The protesters renewed their calls on the international organization to make Saudi Arabia responsible for piracy against Yemeni oil ships. Abdul Latif al-Washali reports.
Yemenis talk together in front of the UN office in Sana'a to slam the UN donor conference and renew their calls on the international organization and the international community to end the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We hope that they will talk about the ships of oil derivatives at the donors' conference. The Yemeni people need fuel just as they need food and medicine. There are thousands of trucks carrying aid that are parked in and could not reach the Yemenis because of the lack of fuel. We want serious action from the United Nations to release oil ships.
Protesters described the UN donor conference as a historical farce. Yemenis said the detained oil vessels must be released and the Saudi war as well as the blockade of Yemen must be stopped.
The donors conference is nothing more than a historical farce. We do not need humanitarian aid, but rather to lift the blockade and release oil ships.
The Yemenis do not need a donor conference as much as they need to bring in oil ships, and we do not want the United Nations to begin in the name of our dear people.
14 Yemeni oil ships remain at the Saudi-led coalition's detention illegally. The vessels were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. The detention has led the country to a harsh shortage of fuel.
Yemenis say instead of raising funds for its organization's expenses, the UN must pressure Saudi Arabia to release the detained oil vessels if it wants to help the humanitarian situation. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
And Japan has extended a COVID-19 state of emergency in the capital by a fortnight, less than 5 months before the Tokyo Olympics. Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga announced the decision, which will affect Tokyo and three neighboring regions. The state of emergency was issued in January and is set to end on March the 7th. It calls for restaurants and cafes to close at 8 p.m. People are also asked to stay home at night unless for essential reasons. The measures had brought infections down in the capital, but the rate of decline is reversing now. Tokyo logged around 270 daily cases on an average over the past week. This says the city is preparing to host the Olympics from July the 23rd. The games were postponed in March last year due to the pandemic. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
The FBI Director Christopher Wray has condemned the 6th of January riot at the U.S. Capitol as an instance of domestic terrorism, whilst defending the Bureau's handling of intelligence indicating that violence was likely. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Joanne Grieve. The piece is titled, FBI Chief Calls Capitol Attack Domestic Terrorism and Defends U.S. Intelligence. Stay with us for more of Joanne Grieve's article. FBI Director Christopher Wray has condemned the 6th of January riot at the U.S. Capitol as an instance of domestic terrorism, whilst defending the FBI's handling of intelligence indicating that violence was likely. That attack, that siege was criminal behavior, plain and simple, and it's behavior that we, the FBI, view as domestic terrorism, Wray told the Senate Judiciary Committee on Tuesday, 2nd of March 2021. He also said the Bureau was pursuing about 2,000 domestic terrorism investigations, up from 1,400 cases at the end of 2020. Donald Trump incited the Capitol attack, telling his supporters at a rally near the White House to fight like hell in an attempt to overturn his electoral defeat based on the lie, repeatedly thrown out of court, that Biden won thanks to electoral fraud. 5 people, including a Capitol police officer, were killed in the riot. Donald Trump was impeached on a charge of inciting an insurrection, but acquitted when only 7 Republican senators voted to convict him. Christopher Wray told senators the attack had no place in our democracy, and tolerating it would make a mockery of our nation's rule of law. The FBI was aggressively pursuing those who carried out the attack, he said, adding that investigations were underway in 55 of 56 FBI field officers. More than 200 people have been charged. His comments in his first appearance before Congress since the Capitol attack amounted to the FBI's most vigorous defense against the suggestion it did not adequately communicate to police the distinct possibility of violence as lawmakers gathered to certify presidential election results on Wednesday, 6th of January. The FBI Director Christopher Wray told lawmakers information was properly shared before the riot, even though it was raw and unverified. A 5th of January report from the FBI field office in Norfolk, Virginia, warned of online posts foreshadowing a war in Washington the following day. Capitol Police leaders have said they were unaware of that report and received no intelligence from the FBI that would have led them to expect a sort of violence which ensued. Christopher Wray said the Norfolk report was shared through the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, discussed at a command post, and posted on an internal portal. Ideally, the FBI would have had more time to try to corroborate it, he said. Our folks made the judgment to get that to the relevant people as quickly as possible, Ray said. He was also pressed on how the FBI is confronting a national security threat from white nationalists and domestic violent extremists, and whether it has adequate resources to address those issues. Christopher Wray described white supremacist extremism as a persistent, evolving threat that has grown since he took over the FBI in 2017. White supremacists make up the biggest chunk of our domestic terrorism portfolio overall, he said, adding that such people have been responsible for the most lethal attacks over the last decade. The violence at the Capitol made clear that a law enforcement agency that remade itself after the 11 September 2001 attacks to deal with international terrorism is now scrambling to address homegrown violence and terrorism from white Americans. The Biden administration has asked its National Intelligence Director, Avril Haines, to work with the FBI and Department of Homeland Security to assess that threat. In his opening statement, FBI Director Christopher Wray said, 6th of January was not an isolated event. The problem of domestic terrorism has been metastasizing across the country for a number of years now, and it's not going away anytime soon. The committee chairman, Dick Durbin, asked if the FBI believed the insurrection was carried out by fake Trump protesters. The Illinois Democrats' question came 2 weeks after Republican Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson amplified baseless claims that left-wing provocateurs carried out the attack on the Capitol. We have not seen evidence of that at this stage, Christopher Wray said. In answer to Patrick Leahy of Vermont, another Democratic senator, he said, we have not, to date, seen any evidence of anarchist violence, extremists, or people subscribing to Antifa, anti-fascist groups in connection with 6th of January. Wray has kept a low profile since the Capitol attack. Though he has briefed lawmakers and shared information with law enforcement, Tuesday's hearing was his first public appearance before Congress since before the election. He was also likely to face questions about a massive Russian hack of corporations and U.S. government agencies, which happened when elite hackers injected malicious code into a software update.
We get people.
U.S. Media Monopoly.
The role that the media and the press play in the United States is crucial for both people high up in power and for those on the streets. It's no surprise that spreading disinformation has real-world consequences. In some cases, dangerous ones. Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javan Mardi, and in this episode, we will ask, how much of the truth does the mass media reflect as the human quest for truth continues? We will try to find out what potential dangers could be arising from the monopoly on mainstream media in the United States. And then, what about the viewers facing a barrage of fake news and partisan media channels? Is there any trust left? Thank you for staying with us.
It amazes me when I read the Wall Street Journal, which is always so negative.
It amazes me when I read the New York Times is not even, I barely read it. You know, we don't distribute it in the White House anymore, and the same thing with the Washington Post. They are siding with China. They are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. They're siding with many others. China's the least of it. It is fake news. It's more than fake news. It's corrupt news.
Media outlets work based on profit, and they have never been more consolidated than today. They tend to give their consumers what they want to hear and act in the interests of the umbrella corporations controlling them. On the other hand, U.S.-owned social media such as Twitter and Facebook are amplifying disinformation and cracking down on freedom of speech.
What they choose to fact-check and what they choose to ignore or even promote is nothing more than a political activism group or political activism, and it's inappropriate.
But I think one of the most terrifying parts of it involves a suggestion that the government should be setting ground rules for what speech is or is not allowed on a platform.
Today, concentration of media ownership by only a few companies or individuals has a big say in the United States' political spectrum. Former President Donald Trump was banned from Twitter after he refused to accept the election result. Yet for years, Trump had been using the platform to issue threats to other nations and politicians. We're now joined by Mr. Tim Kirby. Mr. Kirby, please tell us about the disinformation being projected today and how it's changed through time, and what makes it unique and specifically dangerous.
This is nothing new, and disinformation has existed throughout all time, and even during the more golden age of the media that people sort of prop up, like the 50s and 60s and 70s, this height of journalistic integrity, even then it really existed as well. So I don't think that the disinformation existing is particularly different now. The difference is that with the rise of the internet and the accessibility of the internet, the speed and the ability to be disinformed from various different sources has sort of changed the nature of the game. There's more competition, and the speed is much faster.
Trump's lack of access to Twitter has indeed shifted the dynamics of the so-called MAGA movement under President Biden. The particular platform that has blocked certain figures will lose their supporters not just on the platform, but also in the stocks. Twitter shares closed down more than 6% lower on the first trading day after the Trump ban.
We've seen abuse, we've seen harassment, we've seen people leave our platform because of it, we've seen voices being silenced because of what's happening on the service, and that is number one. Like, we can't build a platform of speech, a platform of conversation, and a service that will remain relevant to people if people don't feel safe to speak up in the first place. So for all those who believe in free expression and all those who believe in free speech, it's critical that we're not utilizing technologies like Twitter to shut down voices.
Liberal media's tough stance on the Capitol siege Trumpists also has long-term ramifications that will widen the gap in America. It also unashamedly panders to the Democrats. That is how the media is playing its part in the American divide.
It's no surprise to see distrust in media, as well as rising partisanship, extremism, and even domestic terrorism. But how did we get here? Let's see what Kristen Harris thinks. Mr. Harris, your take.
I think that the major issue with disinformation is it pushes people to go look in different areas for their news. For example, you have a larger amount of people than ever that are getting their news from forums, like what we saw with the QAnon thing, where they no longer trust the mainstream media narrative due to all the disinformation that to them is easily debunked because they can go search on the internet for alternative facts or different informations or downloads that may support their point of view.
Take what the conservatives call cancel culture and how it's raging today on social media. Many right-wing figures are being canceled on social media, and the conservative voice is being silenced at a time when the election is being disputed and recognition of the new president is under question.
So what happened with your Twitter account and the company page?
Well, first mine was taken down because we have all the election fraud with these Dominion machines. We have 100% proof. And then I when they took it down about 3 weeks ago, and then I put it back up. My personal, I put it. It was a
Mike. Thank you very much, Mike. You're talking about machines that we at Newsmax have not been able to verify any of those kinds of allegations. We just want to let people know that there's nothing substantive that we've seen. And let me read you something there. While there were some clear evidence of some cases of vote fraud and election irregularities, the election results in every state were certified.
As liberals retake power in the year 2021, the left-leaning media looks more aggressive than ever in the wake of the Trump era. The liberal agenda and how it is using mass media to promote it is a lengthy one. But forced equity, diversity, as well as political correctness are reshaping the American society in a fashion that could ultimately spin out of control. So what are the costs of a biased media today?
Adrenaline junkies and people of different right-wing groups were involved, and one of those was QAnon people. And the reason why people turn to things like QAnon, it's because the media has become so biased to one point of view, to the point where a whole half of the United States doesn't deem them credible. And even the people on the left question what the mainstream media narrative is. So what it does is it forces people to get their news from forums where strange people post bizarre beliefs. And when you ban all the independent media, essentially under the guise of Russian collusion, there's no gatekeeper there.
The pace of media takeovers by large national and multinational corporations has been increasing since mid-20th century. Currently, six giant conglomerates control 90% of what media consumers read, watch, and listen to. General Electric, Viacom, Time Warner, CBS, News Corp, and Disney control a majority of American-owned media.
Together, these six empires, federations, alliances own about 90% of all media in the United States. In 1983, or the old Republic era, there were 50 companies owning that same share of media. So why is this important? Should you be worried? Well, it's not exactly a black and white issue.
Enormous media conglomerates have expanded their influence, leading to a shortage of meaningful content and alternative viewpoints. Trust in the news media is being eroded, and some communities are growing in their own alternate reality, yielded by the one-sided media they consume. How do media treat those trying to disrupt its agenda?
I think the idea of this pro-Trump revolution was terrifying enough that they've now put the stakes down. Because even before this, they started to ban conservatives who are more, I don't want to say extreme, more eccentric conservatives, more vibrant conservatives, like Alex Jones and a few others. But now they've just blanket attack any conservative who is conservative or right-wing enough to not accept their agenda.
Trump's supporters' attack on the Capitol is one contemporary example of how media falsehood could create cults. The former president's fans refused to accept the reality that Trump's allegations of election fraud had been left out of court.
They then began fantasizing about how their leader had a hidden trick up his sleeve not to allow Biden to enter office as the president.
Hundreds of thousands of people here, and I just want them to be recognized by the fake news media. Turn your cameras, please, and show what's really happening out here, because these people are not going to take it any longer. They're not going to take it any longer. All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
So in reality, they rushed at the request of the president to supposedly save their democracy and their votes. The other side of the coin is the thirst for truth by the youth, women, people of color, and immigrants, which is yet to be quenched. But what role did U.S. media play in the deadly breach of the Capitol by Trump supporters? And what are the aftermath?
That's an important thing. Because remember, the media always has the option to just ignore something. If it didn't happen on TV, it didn't happen, is the old expression. I would say that maybe now if it didn't happen on YouTube, it didn't happen. We could update that to the 21st century. But they did choose to show it. But they definitely made it clear that these people are bad. They are all Nazis, even the black people who were part of it. and so on. They put a very clear sort of framing on it, and that somehow it is definitely Trump being at fault.
The narrative is controlled by virtue of the ownership of giant media corporations. Many media property owners tend to follow the approach adopted by elected officials who know the truth, but instead choose to propagate lies. Controlled by one czar, the American public would have a good reason to fear for its democracy and remain skeptic about what they read on social media outlets.
Multiple, well-documented significant harms. And we actually have to confront these harms head-on when trying to make decisions about whether or not we embrace this technology and let it into our lives. So one of these harms that we know this technology brings has to do with your professional success. So I just argued before that the ability to focus intensely to produce things that are rare and valuable, to hone skills that the marketplace values, that this is what's going to matter in our economy. But right before that, I argued that social media tools are designed to be addictive.
Stereotype of an American surfing through TV channels somehow captures the struggle for finding out truth. But those high up want to stay in power, prepared to do whatever it takes to manipulate the discourse. How successful have czars controlling U.S. media been in manipulating the narrative?
Well, pretty effective. It's been effective enough to get the United States involved in a lot of wars. The United States has entered World War I, Vietnam, the Iraq and Afghanistan wars over very dubious claims. I mean, we never found those weapons of mass destruction, did we? So in a lot of ways, the narrative is created by the media. And in fact, there's really no other narrative outside of theirs. They control that, they create it, and for better or worse, we receive it. And unfortunately, it would look like as time goes on, it gets worse and worse.
There is no real access to truly diverse and competing sources of news, literature, entertainment, and popular culture. Concentrated power over public information has created a niche for the alternatives. Some are taking advantage of the gap in the market by promoting conspiracy theories. Trump was a master of employing conspiracy theories and using them to his advantage.
You know, every time Donald thinks things are not going in his direction, he claims whatever it is rigged against him. The FBI conducted a year-long investigation into my emails. They concluded there was no case. He said the FBI was rigged. He lost the Iowa caucus. He lost the Wisconsin primary. He said the Republican primary was rigged against him. Then Trump University gets sued for fraud and racketeering. He claims the court system and the federal judge is rigged against him. There was even a time when he didn't get an Emmy for his TV program 3 years in a row, and he started tweeting that the Emmys were rigged.
What is the liberal agenda, and how is it using mass media to promote it? That's what Danny's going to talk about today. Hello, Danny. What do you have for us?
Thank you, Milad. This week, I am talking diversity and answering the questions, does diversity in the United States lead to justice? Does it lead to peace? And how does diversity maintain the status quo amid unprecedented crisis and societal decay? The answer is no. Diversity does not lead to justice, and it doesn't lead to peace. The corporate media has praised Joe Biden for his diverse cabinet, and the Los Angeles Times has given the front page to Kamala Harris, his vice president, who is a black woman, and has praised Joe Biden for nominating Lloyd Austin as the Secretary of Defense. Yet Lloyd Austin was a board member of Raytheon, one of the major weapons manufacturers in the world, which produces weapons of mass destruction deployed in black and brown nations around the world to destroy them. Kamala Harris is an agent of the police state, of the mass incarceration state, as a DA and as a prosecutor and as a senator. She has mocked activists for advocating for the defunding of prisons and the funding of public education. She has also been responsible for massive arrests of black Americans, mainly for minor drug possession. These are not the kind of leaders that diversity should be promoting. So why does the corporate media promote this kind of diversity? Because, in fact, a more diverse empire is a more effective empire. The United States is able to wage wars around the world, institute devastating economic inequality, and maintain a racist power structure, all the while claiming that it in fact has gotten closer to being less racist because of diversity. This is what leads to developments like Donald Trump and the extreme right. And we need to understand how diversity does not mean justice and peace if we are going to have a more progressive and more peaceful future in the United States and abroad.
In the late Obama era, Trump took the chance to put his ideas into test. He told America's story in a rather novel way compared to the US media, and many gravitated to him. After 4 years in office, the president fabricated tens of thousands of lies and baseless allegations, but his supporters still considered him the only honest man in the room. So what were the dynamics of the communication between Trump and his supporters?
Media is the reason why Donald Trump used Twitter. He used it as a way to talk directly to the American people. Not that I agree with the things he said, but it was for the first time in history that we've seen a president be able to communicate directly with the people, and they did this through Twitter. Now, making threats on Twitter, do I think that's a presidential thing to do? Absolutely not. I think that maybe some of it was for show. Some of it was so that the message may not be perverted, but I think a phone call and a conversation would have been a much better option.
Media is at the center of the American power play. Having a real choice of politics and ideas has become a more scarce phenomenon, as many people repeat the talking points fed to them by media, and that is their political view. The media knows that and is somehow making a benefit by pumping that certain attitude towards life and politics.
It's important to believe in, you know, to have respect for everyone's religion.
Do you respect Christianity?
I do.
Judaism?
Yes.
Islam?
No.
Can a woman be president?
The presidency is a man's job.
I have women are qualified to be president.
No. A female has more hormones. She could start a war in 10 seconds.
The people tend to follow news outlets they agree with. The outlets are making money through their supporters, so they're more adamant in highlighting what their viewers want. They could help one another get increasingly ignorant.
The media has the ability to turn the light switch on and off using their data. And for some people, it works very well as far as controlling information and allowing people to download certain viewpoints and conditioning them that certain things are acceptable. There's a large and growing amount of cognitive dissonance amongst Americans due to them watching media.
In a society where inaccuracy and biases abound, seeking truth remains a serious challenge. Media property owners must be held accountable, along with elected officials, for lying to the nation and opting for power over truth. Yet in reality, both the media and officials mostly choose to propagate lies, serving their own interests.
You've used words like garbage and lies and smear to describe the recent wave of stories about your past. Are you saying that organizations like Politico and CNN and the Wall Street Journal are deliberately trying to damage you?
Yes.
Why?
To put it simply, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Why?
Because, you know, when you deliberately lie and you put that out as a story, or you do shabby investigation and you say, we've investigated and we can't find anything. I mean, is that an acceptable standard? I mean, you're in the media. Is that acceptable?
Generally, journalists have to nail down a story before they publish it or broadcast it.
Right. So I don't have any problem with people looking at my past. I don't have any problem whatsoever with being vetted. But when people are outright dishonest, that's worrisome to me.
Our guest tonight is Ted Rall. He's an award-winning
editorial cartoonist and columnist, and author of the new book, Political Suicide, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Ted, thank you for joining us. Let's get to it. We want to know, basically, to what extent the American public has lost faith in what is sometimes referred to as the mainstream media.
There's a allegory relating to people's congressmen. Congress, for a long time in the United States, has had an approval rating hovering around 10, 11, 12%. And yet, incumbent congressmen keep getting reelected. So why? It's because people don't like Congress in general, but they like their own congressmen, or at least they're willing to tolerate them. Same thing, I think, is true about distrust of corporate media. In general, people have an understanding that systemically, they don't trust what comes out of corporate media, that it's a lot of it's propaganda, that the corporate ownership has a huge influence. But in terms of the outlets that they like or that they tolerate, or perhaps more accurately, that they dislike the least, for example, if you're a conservative, that might be Fox. If you're a liberal, that might be MSNBC. They have more of a love-hate relationship with those outlets. And even though they might say that they don't trust the whole system, the fact is they do listen to and watch to these and read these outlets, and it ends up being the source of much of what they believe. So it's, if there was really widespread distrust of all corporate media outlets in the U.S., they wouldn't really have substantial influence. But they clearly do. They shape the narrative in a very real way, so the things that are not true become true, and they become widely accepted. So, for example, Russiagate scandal, or that are, you know, didn't happen, but, you know, most Americans think it did, especially depending on which outlet you watch. So it's kind of like the Congress thing. People don't trust the whole thing overall, but whether they admit it to themselves, much less to pollsters, or not, there are outlets that they are listening to, watching, and reading, and they are trusting them, even though maybe they shouldn't.
Interesting stuff, as always. We want to thank you so much, Ted, for joining us tonight. We want to thank audiences at home for tuning in. For Press TV's We the People, I'm Wyatt Reed. Take care.
Whether it's about the election, public health, or climate change, divide rages on in U.S. media today. This is while the elite in control of news and entertainment keep targeting the average person consuming immense amounts of information, news, and entertainment every day, a phenomenon that has made a large number of Americans addicted to the media. Thank you for watching the show. Please join us again next week when we'll come back with another episode of We the People.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.